This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. In this segment, we're going to be talking with Lieutenant Detective Jason Howe of North Carolina, diving into the Alex Murdaugh case. And I want to start here. You know, in reference to this case, as a detective, I want to get your perception on this and your opinion. That distress call, the 911 call that came in initially with Alex reporting his wife and his son found shot, sounded very, very frantic. In your experience of hearing 911 calls and people acting all different ways, what clues, characteristics can you have when you analyze that to prove or find out if it was in fact truly distressful or someone acting to cover something up? What did you make of that 911 call?
Well, the 911 call itself, you know, there are, I guess, a lot of good actors in the world, and whether or not you're going to take what the emotions that you hear and take a truthful aspect of those, it's difficult to say. I think the biggest thing that tells you about a scene is the evidence itself. Even a very well staged scene, there can be clues from the physical evidence that doesn't line up necessarily with the events that would have occurred. We had a very similar situation in my jurisdiction where there was a homicide and a woman was claiming credit and self-defense. But in reality, the evidence that we collected, ballistics, blood spatter, objects moved around the house, it just didn't add up with her story. So I think the biggest aspect is to look to your physical evidence and make sure that that matches with what you're being told, either from victims or witnesses, which could in reality be suspects.
How difficult is it to take a look at some of that evidence, especially when the crime takes place in one's own home? Their DNA, their fingerprints are naturally going to be all over everything, not necessarily alluding to a murder. How does one, in a case like this, go in and decipher what is something that has to do with the crime and what does not, especially when it involves the resident of the property?
Yeah, well, you know, each piece of physical evidence is always going to be circumstantial. Individually, any kind of forensic evidence has an innocent explanation, even some of the most damning evidence. So if you think of a bloody fingerprint on a knife, it's very easy for someone to say, oh, I put that there because I was trying to help, or I moved the knife away from the person. So it always has innocent explanations. The crucial key, I think, is to take the most amount of evidence that you can find, especially evidence that's related to different disciplines, whether it be DNA, fingerprints, the body of the positions of bodies, understanding the concepts of postmortem intervals to determine how long someone's actually been deceased. You take all of that and you put it together, and those individual pieces start building a larger picture for you. Some of that evidence, as far as fingerprints, when you do have an occupant of the home, you expect to find those there. Now, depending on where you find them in relation to the pieces of other evidence, those could be a clue. But you expect that, you know, fingerprints, DNA, and everything else is going to be present. But when you have a homicide, especially a homicide involving firearms, you can collect a lot of ballistic related evidence, whether that's rifling on a projectile or the stamp on a shell casing from the breech face. And you can tie those to specific weapons. And, you know, my understanding of the Murdaugh case is that some of the evidence that was scattered around the property related to a firearm that could have been owned by the family. So it's important to understand, you know, that if you can collect a piece of evidence, how it relates to that individual case and whether you can individualize it to a particular weapon. Those things could be important clues.
How often do you see it in a murder investigation where someone outside of the family literally goes in and uses family weapons to commit the crime? Because that's appearing to be what happened here in the Murdaugh case. if one is to go on a murder spree or wanting to take a hit out on somebody, wouldn't you expect them to bring their own guns to the scene rather than just, oh, I'll pick one up there while I'm hanging out?
I would, unless it's a crime of opportunity. Maybe if it's a home invasion or somebody burglarized the residence and happened to find a gun. Most of the time, it's going to be someone, if they're preparing to commit a murder, they're going to use a weapon that's available to them. Now, I say that with a grain of salt, because there's also been cases where we've had suspects that have burglarized the house by whatever means, and they've actually found a firearm and attacked the homeowner with their own firearm. But it's kind of rare.
What's your take on it being two different weapons that were used to kill both of the victims?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, it could have been a staging implication there to make it the crime scene look like it was staged. Mm-hmm. Maybe make it look like there were more than one offenders that were present at the scene. I honestly think that maybe it could have possibly involved one victim being killed at a different time than the other. Mm-hmm. You could have killed one of the victims with one firearm and laid the foundation to basically get the other family member to approach, and then they could have been killed with a different firearm. I think a lot of that could involve staging without knowing all of the facts. That would just be one of the assumptions you could make.
What is your take on the claims about Alex turning the bodies and his involvement, getting close to them the right after he claims that he found them? Yet he has on a stark white T-shirt that doesn't seem to have any blood on it when he gets into the police car for the interrogation.
Yeah, it would depend on how bloody the scene was, but you would expect that when someone interacts with an environment that is that contains a lot of blood, and they are also manipulated the bodies, that they would have at least some trace of that blood on their person.
I mean, it seems in one way it works to his advantage because there was no blood splatter on him if he was in fact the shooter, but his claims that he went right up to the bodies and laid down, tried to turn one of them over, and some of the claims that he makes of the position of the bodies were not even exactly correct. Now, this, of course, could be a trauma response, and one is going through that. Not everything is adding up as you're speaking it. I think that's part of what the argument is being made. But how strong does that stand up?
Well, I think it does happen in cases. It's really important for the investigators, you know, to look at those issues where the body has been moved. You know, whenever you're dealing with a deceased individual, there's postmortem indicators such as lividity, rigor mortis, and algor mortis that all set in at different intervals. And, you know, you could tell if a body's been moved from one position to another, depending on how much time has elapsed since the death has occurred.
I'm curious to get your take on how things played out in the investigation from what we've seen in the video footage and elsewhere. Obviously, we are talking about a legacy of the Murdaugh family and a lot of things being kind of swept under the rug or favors being done. It's been described as kind of a good old boys atmosphere. You yourself are in the Carolinas. Can you speak to how some of that works or what you may have seen in different points in time in your career of that sort of, scratch my back, I'll scratch yours?
I haven't seen a lot of, the back scratching. What I have seen a lot of is there's evidence, and you can categorize it kind of two different ways. You can categorize it in the evidence that you can see and the evidence that you can't necessarily visualize. A lot of the evidence that we deal with in a criminal investigation or a crime scene investigation, some of it's microscopic, some of it's, you know, easily contaminated, easily disturbed. And I think the issue that I see more is taking care with your scene not to introduce or contaminate the evidence that's there, especially things that could be important like shoe wear impressions, DNA that's left behind. All of that could be easily destroyed or cross-contaminated if officers aren't careful. And the more officers that you have respond to a scene, The more emergency responders that you have as far as individuals with the fire department or emergency services, you run into an issue that you're introducing more and more people that could disturb these scenes. Once you realize that, you know, there's a death and maybe the individuals are beyond help, the best practice is to go ahead and contain your scene and limit the individuals that are coming and going from it.
Then that's a question I have, because we saw from the videos the very next day after the murders, the gun room. It almost looked like the Murdaugh family was sitting in there watching a game or something. And then there was investigators kind of coming and going, excuse me, want to take a look at this, want to take a look at that. It almost, in many ways, looked like it was purposely being contaminated, that, or it was just the assumption that Alec didn't do this and we're just kind of doing our thing. It just seemed very unprofessional from an outside standpoint. You being a detective and in that world far more than I am, what was your observations?
Yeah, having individuals remain in the scene, it's a poor practice in my eyes. I try to secure the crime scene, remove individuals, and make sure that the only individuals that are going back into the scene are trained individuals, whether they're part of the investigative team as detective or a crime scene investigator. That's just the best practice. I've seen occasions where, maybe when the initial responding officers are there, that once the crimes occurred, that maybe they're a little slow to react to the people that are moving around the scene. But the longer that goes on, the more chance you have to contaminate or destroy evidence that could be valuable in the investigation.
Do you think there was anything going on that was almost purposely contaminating the scene so that it couldn't be used in court?
I didn't see anything that was intentionally going on. It's just, you have to take care. You have an outdoor crime scene. You could have clues, whether they be in sand, mud, close to the body, further from the body. You have to take care that, you're preserving those things.
Lieutenant Detective Jason Howe, thank you for your insight into this case that you're giving us from your perspective. Greatly appreciate that. If you like the podcast, press subscribe so you don't miss any breaking updates, discussion, and coverage of this case. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter @TonyBPod. Until next time, for all of us here, thanks for listening.